broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Good morning, guys. Good morning in the studio there as well. How are you?
Very well.
Good morning. Another busy week for everyone, I'm sure.
Mate, we're churning through them.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
And Louis, a very busy week for you. You've got your daughter has gone back to school.
Congratulations to all the parents who have put their children back in school this week for all the preps to year twos in Victoria and 11s and 12s in Victoria. You bastards around the rest of the country got it earlier than us, but we've got it now, and I'm holding thumbs for you guys who have children in the middle years who are not yet at school. So good luck to you for only the next week now. So that's nice. Not long now.
Look, I admire you, Louis. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a parent, and I can only imagine how challenging that was to have your child at home and trying to do the homeschooling and balancing work around it. I mean, you guys are saints, I think, by my books. Mm-hmm. Especially from the parents I've dealt with, I just think, wow, you guys are remarkable.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
absolutely.
It has been a remarkable time. And I find what comes out from it is a range of different opinions, and some people think that they've got it worst. Other people think that their unique circumstances are the worst. But then some people, the people who you think are the worst off, are actually like, no, I'm all good. Like a neighbour of ours has three kids. One has gone back into school this week. One's a brand new newborn. And I've been thinking, well, surely that's the most stressful situation when you've got school-aged kids at home and a newborn during the coronavirus period. God, you must be stressed out of your brains. And she says, nah, we're staying at home just like we normally would with the family, wow, three kids under six. So it's not actually impacting us very much at all. In fact, it's probably better because now the husband is staying home to work from home a lot more.
Yeah.
And that's really convenient and helpful. But I couldn't think of anything worse.
No, it's funny, people's reaction, isn't it? Like it's really, and it's true. It's the ones that you think aren't going to cope with as much. I've got a friend that's absolutely relished being in isolation. Yeah. And I would have thought she was very social, but she has been loving it, like out for walks and you know, getting fresh air and thinking it's the best thing that she's ever had happen. So it's quite amazing.
Yeah,
the only thing I'd say for parents that are like that the thing that I've noticed is not having the commute to school and that sort of early morning scramble, I think for a lot of people has really helped them sort of have a bit of an easier life in that regard. So.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. And especially if there's a choice to go to a school that's not nearby to you, people who are driving 20 minutes in the wrong direction to drop their kids at school, well, now they've got a 40-minute saving. Well, they have that anyway.
Yeah.
But it's going back now.
It'll be interesting how it all returns, that's for sure.
Well, there's less than 700 active cases across Australia at the moment. And I think there's only about 68 live cases in Victoria all up. So if this keeps up, at some point in time in the next 3 or 4 weeks, we might not even have a coronavirus in Australia.
Well, you'd hope not. I think they've done a pretty good job. I've got to say, I was really quite annoyed when they first decided they were going to shut everything down. But I must give credit where credit's due. And I think the government's done a remarkable job of really getting it under control.
I think so. Anyone that tries to argue about a misstep or anything like that, you're arguing about the one percenters. I think everyone's in agreement that more than 90% of the steps have been in the right direction and with the right kind of advice.
Yeah, and it's certainly nothing that we've ever seen before, so you can understand that there are going to be, you know, mistakes along the way, but all in all, handled very well.
Yeah, and we've seen what it's actually happened over in the US and in northern Italy and in places like Spain, and now we're seeing it in Brazil and Russia. You know, where it has, you know, really taken hold there and gotten out of control. So we certainly, in many respects, continue to be the lucky country.
And, I mean, Joel, for you, I mean, you've been going into the office pretty much every day, so life has been sort of a little bit more usual for you. Have you started to see more people come back in the city? Even though I'm living in the city, I don't get out of our apartment. So tell me what life's like out there.
Definitely. In fact, I just made mention of it yesterday to a couple of people who I was working with, and Brett yesterday in the office, that we're probably, if we were down 95%, and you know, in all honesty, at the worst of it in early April, late March, the city was a ghost town. We're probably now back to around about 25% of what it was like pre-coronavirus, and in fact, maybe even yesterday, you could make an argument that it's probably getting to about 30% of the volume of people that was around pre-coronavirus. So there's still a long way to go, but I'm certainly seeing a lot more traffic in the city in the mornings. I'm still certainly seeing a lot more people out at lunchtimes walking the streets. I've certainly seen a number of cafes open up this week that had been shut for the best part of a couple of months or so. And I think that as we go through over the next 3 weeks, you know, Monday we have a huge lowering of restrictions. We're allowed 20 people in cafes and restaurants and bars, and then that increases to 50 on the 22nd of June. I think progressively you're going to see more and more. And I know the Victorian government has mentioned that they would like to see people remain working from home until at least the end of June. So, look, I think, you know, we've probably got about four and a bit weeks before we start to see the traffic in the city and the cafes and restaurants get back to some sort of real normality. But it's heading in the right direction. And there does, I don't know, there seems to be an air of optimism at the moment that hasn't been around for some time.
Great to hear. All right. Well, look, let's kick off this podcast for this morning. We're going to throw you first, Joel, and you're going to talk to us about Warren Buffett. And has he lost his nerve? That's a big call, Joel. Tell us more about what you think.
Is he getting too old for it?
Well, Warren Buffett is 89. Now, I'm not trying to be ageist here, but he is 89 years of age. And look, the guy is probably the most famous investor in the whole world. Over his career, his average returns of around about 17% per annum, compounded over a 50-year investment span. So, if you do the numbers on that, you know, and you compound your investment capital at 17% over a 50-year period of time, you get to some pretty substantial numbers. In fact, if I just quickly punch in the calculator here, just bear with me.
Yeah, I'll beat you to it, Joel. Your investment's gone up by 2,566 times.
So $1,000 invested 50 years ago is now worth $2.56 million.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty good to me.
It's not bad, right? And it's life-changing types of returns. The real concern or the real discussion point that's taking place at the moment, though, is the way that Warren Buffett has been acting over the last 10 years and some of the investment decisions that he's made. And certainly the light has shone again on Warren Buffett and his performance as a result of coronavirus. Now, we're talking about a guy here who is famous for some of the for creating some of the, you know, investment world's most well recognized quotes, and in particular the one that he is most famous for is "Be fearful when people are greedy, and be greedy when people are fearful." But in this most recent episode of the coronavirus, Warren Buffett has been a net seller of stocks, and a net seller of stocks at the peak of the hysteria in the coronavirus market sell off. Now, Warren Buffett is famous. Let's get an understanding. Warren Buffett's famous for investing in brand name capital efficient businesses. That's how he's largely been known since the 70s and the 80s and the 90s around his investment style. It's buying big brand name, capital efficient businesses that have resilient business models, that have strong economic moats, and buying them when he can buy them at a discount to their intrinsic value.
What were some of his big wins, Joel?
Well, some of his big wins, he was famous for buying Geico, which is the government employees insurance company in America. If you've ever been to America, Geico is famous for the gecko.
Yeah.
And its advertisements. And then he also made a ton of money buying Coca-Cola in the early 80s, during the early 80s economic turmoil. He also bought huge stakes in the Washington Post. And remember, going back into the 80s and the 90s, newspapers were a license to print money back in the day. So he made huge amounts of money, particularly in, you know, buying these big brand name businesses that everybody just continued to buy their products and their services. And he bought them when they were dirt cheap in tough economic times. So I think he started building a big stake in Coca-Cola in the 1987 sell-off, and the same again with the Washington Post. He bought a huge stake in Geico, I believe, during the late 70s and early 80s, during the inflation era crisis and the 1982 recession, and he gradually built that stake up over time. And he made plenty of money during that. But in recent years, particularly in the 2000s, his fate has been a lot and his decision-making has been a lot more patchy, if we could say that. And over the last 10 years, Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway have actually underperformed the S&P 500. Now, for a guy who has such a stellar track record and such an impressive history, for him to underperform the stock market in any one year is quite rare, but for him to do it consistently over a 10-year stretch, you know, you start to question why is this happening. And if you know anything about the investment phases of Warren Buffett, he made most of his money earning returns of around about 30 to 40% returns when he was in the early phase of his investment career, when he had small amounts of money to invest and he could take advantage of significant mispricings in smaller stocks. And he was a much more active trader because he only had a smaller pool of capital to invest in, so he could take advantage of a lot more opportunities where mispricing arose. He then, as he started to grow and the capital started to accumulate, he could no longer take advantage of those opportunities, one, because he started to become so famous that other people started to mimic his strategy, so it stopped working. But two, the universe of opportunities that were available to him to run that strategy also started to dry up as he got bigger. So he changed his investment approach when he met Charlie Munger, and that's where he led to making these acquisitions and investing in these more capital efficient businesses rather than deep value businesses that were on the verge of going out of business and then hope buying them for a turnaround. But in recent years, and certainly since the sort of mid-2000s, he's changed his approach. And for years, he had espoused that he would never buy an airline. And all of a sudden, he's bought a whole portfolio of airlines over the last number of years. And he was a major panic net seller in this most recent sell-off as a result of coronavirus, where Warren Buffett, you know, famous for buying when people are fearful, actually looks like he's caved in during this period of time. He was also a big seller of banks as well. He owned a number of banks which he'd got rid of, Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase and Bancorp USB and Bank of New York Mellon. And these are some of the stocks that he just sold right at the peak of this sell-off.
Yeah.
And he also dumped his holdings in American Airlines, Delta Airlines. Now, you can question whether or not he should have been in these stocks in the first place because – you know, the Warren Buffett that, you know, was around in the 80s and 90s would talk about investing, you know, in businesses that had light capital business models. Well, airlines are anything but that, right? They don't. They're a price taker. They don't control the biggest input cost, which is jet fuel. They run a commodities type business, essentially. I mean, it's seats on an airplane.
Yes, there's different levels of service, but by and all, the difference between what one airline provides for first class and economy is not all that different to what the other airline does. He's investing in airlines is you're dealing with irrational competitors. Many airlines are owned by governments and Saudi princes and the like, and so it's more of a badge of honor to have an airline rather than run it at a profit. So, you know, why he actually went into airlines in the first place, I'm not sure.
I was going to question, though. I mean, from the documentaries that I've actually watched with you on Warren Buffett, he seems to be a very sort of traditional guy. And from my experience in watching him, he doesn't really follow the technology side of things very well. He's very traditional with reading newspapers. And I just wonder if he's lost his edge by sort of being a little bit of a dinosaur with how he conducts himself.
Well, Steph, you're absolutely right here. And I mean, if you're a new investor to the game and you're thinking about, you know, who are the best people to invest with, and you're trying to make a decision, well, certainly Warren Buffett is going to be at the top of that list. But you're absolutely right. He's missed huge secular trends over the last 10 to 15 years. He's completely stepped away from technology. He's claimed that he didn't understand what technology is, and so he stayed away from it. Now, if you think of how the world runs today, it runs on software. It runs on interconnectivity of the internet. It runs on, you know, all of these amazing new platforms that enable e-commerce. Now, it's not that technology has changed the appeal of buying consumer cyclicals and consumer discretionary items, which Warren Buffett tends to like. It's just that the means for selling those goods and services have changed, and he's completely missed the boat as to how the marketplace has changed. To not take the time to get to understand what's going on in this secular trend and to just dismiss it and say, I don't understand it, I actually think is irresponsible, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a money manager, it should be his responsibility to get to understand these new businesses and these new business models and understand the changes that are taking place in consumer preferences. He made a big blunder with Kraft Heinz. He missed the whole healthier eating. He missed the whole, change in consumer preference for healthier foods, and decided that he would stick to his old 1950s and 1960s brands of buying, you know, Kraft peanut butter and Heinz, you know, baked beans and spaghetti. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I don't know anyone who buys those these days. as good as his reputation is, you've also got to be critical of what he's currently doing at the moment. And right now the results show that he has underperformed by quite some margin against the S&P 500 over the last 10 years. And the decisions that he's taking today don't give me any confidence that he's actually following what he's been made famous for, where he seems to have been panicked during the coronavirus. And even though you had some of the world's biggest and best companies, companies that are big enough for Warren Buffett to buy, trading at 30 and 40% down on where they were prior to the coronavirus taking place, he hasn't bought one stock. During this downturn,
I find him unusual, though, that he'd still want to remain doing what he's doing, considering his age and that he had made enough money. I mean, obviously, you tell me, for an investor like that, is it the rush of it? Because he's never changed his house. He eats the same breakfast that he's eaten for, since he can remember. I mean, what do you think it is about somebody that wants to remain in a business after they've made such an exorbitant amount of money and could have got out at the peak?
Well, it's the thrill of the game, I think. I mean, at the end of the day, investing is a highly intellectually stimulating pursuit. And, I could tell you right now that even if I sold UGC, I would continue investing just because it becomes a passion for most people.
And
a lot of the traits around Warren Buffett, keeping that consistency, over time has served him very well, because it's meant that he's been rigid in his approach, he's been consistent with his approach. All of those things have been true and accurate up until the last 10 to 15 years, where he seems to have strayed into highly cyclical energy businesses like buying ConocoPhillips, believing in peak oil. You know, he's now, you know, buying airlines, he's buying banks, and he's now selling into weakness instead of buying into weakness.
Yeah.
And, you know, seems to just be struggling to grapple the current modern economy and the way that markets have evolved over the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, 10 to 15 years is not a very – I mean, that's a long time to get it wrong. So, I mean, I'd be starting to question myself and thinking, do I need to get some new blood in there to really think about changing my strategy? Because that is an awful long time and something that wouldn't be looked at favorably to get it wrong for those many years.
Yeah, and you're right. And the other thing is, you know, remember, he's 89 years of age. So if you're thinking about investing in Berkshire Hathaway because of all of the great things that you've heard about, you know, Warren Buffett over the last 50 years, he's not going to be there most likely as the CEO of Berkshire Hathaway within 10 years' time. Mm-hmm. So you need to then have a look at, okay, well, who are the deputies behind him? And how have they performed? And the reality is that they haven't actually done much better themselves. These two deputies that
Charlie
are behind
Munger
them.
Older?
They're younger. When I say younger, they're, you know, in their 50s. So they're, you know, they've got good careers behind them. But they themselves are actually underperforming the benchmarks as well over the last 5 years since they've joined Berkshire Hathaway.
But that could be down to the management there, Joel, and the fact that they've sort of got a toe line with him. So I just wonder, I mean, if he's so rigid in his approach, maybe it is very, very difficult to change his mind and they're being told to sort of follow a certain methodology.
Well, we are told certainly that they are value investors. And, look, there is no doubt that in the last 10 years, growth-type companies, those companies that are exposed to the new economy, the gig economy, have done a lot better. And Warren Buffett's approach has been much more focused around valuations and buying low-value stocks and buying stocks that have got cheap price-to-earnings ratios. But the problem is that most of those companies that have got cheap price-to-earnings ratios right now are cheap not because they've gone through a cyclical downturn. They're cheap because they're missing out on a major secular change in the global economy. And they don't demand high price-to-earnings ratios because they're not growing and not able to adapt to the current way that we conduct business. So I think there needs to be a rethink at how Berkshire Hathaway goes about its investment approach. There is a way to be a growth investor but also consider valuations, and many of the methods that we're applying here at UGC take exactly that approach in that we understand that over the long term, and Warren Buffett said this himself, over the long term, the biggest determinant of how a share price performs is how much profit of a business grows. Yet there seems to be a lot of companies that Warren Buffett is trying to invest in right now that have had very poor and spotty track records of profit growth. And I think there needs to be some form of a reassessment. You don't have to buy technology businesses to outperform. But what you do need to find is businesses that are growing their profits on a sustainable basis. And that's one of the key factors that I think Warren Buffett has somewhat departed from in recent years by buying companies that have patchy and very cyclical earnings profiles or are very capital intensive, like his investment in Burlington Northern Santa Fe Rail Company. So something to consider here, and I think the you know, if I was to have a look at most of Warren Buffett's errors over the past 10 or 15 years, the classic error that he seems to be making right now is that he's not focusing on those businesses that have a sustainable growth trajectory in their profitability. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think there is a mistake that's happening. And it's also been where we've been able to outperform quite dramatically through this coronavirus sell-off is because we've had a lot of businesses in our portfolio that have those sustainable revenue models that are relatively immune to market events like what we're seeing. We're invested largely in businesses that have, you know, subscription-based revenue models that are critically important to the way that businesses and humans survive and function. You just have to keep buying their products regardless of how bad the economy has been, and that's served us extremely well. We're now net positive for most of our portfolios for the year to date, while the S&P 500 is down around about 7%, and the ASX 200 is down somewhere around about 17-18% year to date still.
Well, that's good advice. And move over, Warren, ladies and gentlemen. Come and see UGC if you want some advice on your portfolios.
Can I just emphasise that for a second?
Sure you can, Louis.
From the 1st of January to today, UGC's share portfolio is up, positive.
Yeah.
Just an emphasis on that. And I ran some numbers on it yesterday. Your so-called top performing super funds in Australia are still minus 10.
Wow. Yeah, big difference.
Yeah. It is, yeah. And look, I can vouch for you guys, so I'd say to come and see you too.
Glad to
All right,
that.
Look, guys, we're going to throw to a quick break, and we're going to be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Okay, and welcome back. We're now going to throw over to Louis. Louis, you're going to talk us through the coronavirus withdrawals from our super funds that we can make and the ability to put it back in at a later date. And I think there's a little bit of controversy around that at the moment. Can you explain a bit more about it?
Yeah, there is, and I may need to issue a retraction of some kind because I was earlier in a different episode, I was promoting a scheme where people can withdraw from their superannuation funds under the government's coronavirus withdrawal measures and then recontribute that money back into superannuation. And the way that scheme works is if you have had a reduction in your income or your work hours, but you've still got some kind of income for the financial year, so you're still going to have some tax to pay, well, if you qualify for a $10,000 withdrawal, but you don't actually need the money, then you could take that withdrawal, receive that money in cash, and then put it straight back into your super fund, and the act of contributing it into your super fund is a personal tax deductible contribution to you. So you're getting a tax benefit just for moving money out of super and then straight back into super. And on the surface of it, there's nothing in the superannuation laws that prevents it. And there's no firm statement from anyone saying that you can't do it. Well, not that I've been able to find anyway. But I may still need to remove my advice to do so because there's certainly been indications from the ATO that they don't like it, which is a bit of a Pauline Hanson reaction. Not exactly clear, so I've tried to scratch further and we're now starting to get into the areas of tax law. Now, I'm not a tax lawyer. So if you are looking at doing this, then maybe look into the legal advice. But what I can see is that the major piece of legislation in tax law is known as Part 4, and specifically Part 4A is around the anti-tax avoidance measures. And when you read it, a lot of it comes down to the intent And there's a number of facts to consider when the ATO is looking at whether someone has gone into a scheme just for the purpose to avoid tax. The words in one of the ATO guidances is, would it be concluded that you entered into the scheme or carried out for the scheme for the sole or dominant purpose of obtaining the tax benefit? And this applies to all areas of tax law. You're actually not allowed to go into any tax scheme or strategy where the sole purpose is to reduce tax. Damn it. It's actually against the law to minimize your tax.
Party police.
All you're allowed to do is you're allowed to do schemes for a purpose where the secondary benefit is to reduce tax. It just happens to be a side effect. Like if you're buying an investment property, the sole purpose is to buy a property that grows in value or produces rent income. A nice side effect would be to reduce tax.
That's a very murky area, though, isn't it, really?
I mean,
people do this all the time to really think about reducing their tax. So it's murky.
Yep. So how is the ATO going to prove that you have gone into a scheme just for the purpose of reducing tax? And this is where, well, the ATO, they might have a window into your tax records. They might have a window into Centrelink and other government agencies. Maybe one day it'll get Big Brother and they'll have a window into your bank accounts and maybe they'll have a pair of binoculars on the other side of the street and have a window into your bedroom. But what they don't have is a window into your brain. So how can they know what you are thinking at the time? So they're not going to know that you were thinking, aha, I'm just doing it to get a tax benefit. But there are pointers. So if you do a coronavirus withdrawal and then the day after you receive the money, you put that back into super, well, it paints a picture that that was your intent.
Right.
But if you do a withdrawal from super and your intention is to have more available cash for your emergency fund because you're worried about your job prospects or you're worried about future cash flow, if that's your dominant purpose at the time of doing the withdrawal, then that's your dominant purpose.
Mm. What happens if I was to put the money back in a couple of years later?
Well, if it just so happens that your job security firms up within a month's time.
Which is not out of the question for many people.
Which is exactly not out of the question at all.
That's why I think it's very hard to sort of prove in this instance. So.
Yeah, that's right. So whether it's the conditions changing in a month's time or whether it's conditions changing in 6 months' time. So if the withdrawal happens this year but a recontribution to super happens next year, it's a tricky thing for the ATO to see. So so look, what does it come back to? Well, it comes back to your level of honesty. Mm-hmm. And if your level of honesty is true, that's your dominant purpose is to withdraw from super for reasons of security or cash flow or some purpose like that, I will say you're not allowed to withdraw from super where the dominant purpose is to obtain a tax deduction. And that is my official words.
Line, okay. But, Louis, they did put out some kind of a picture, you said. Was it on Twitter?
Well, here's the thing. So I was looking for what has the ATO actually said to tell people not to do it. I'm looking for press releases saying super recontribution strategies are not allowed, all sorts of things, and I can't find any. All I find is something on a Twitter feed from the ATO commissioner, and it doesn't refer to anything saying this is not allowed. Here's what it says. It's got a cute picture of what looks to be a hipster with a Fitbit and a smartphone.
Bit of smash dabo.
And probably, that's right. And the words say, meet Matt. Matt thinks he can withdraw his super early and recontribute it to gain a personal tax deduction. Don't be like Matt.
See, it's not that's murky as well. It's not like you cannot do this. It's like, don't be like him. What does that mean?
Exactly. So the ATO is saying, well, we don't want people to do it.
Yeah.
But if there was actually a if there were if they had the ability to give a clear indication that this will not be allowed,
correct,
then they would give that. Yeah, but they haven't given that.
Let's really think about this, right? We've just gone through probably one of the worst recessions that we've seen since the 1990s and maybe even since the Great Depression, even though it could be short and sharp. So how is the ATO going to legitimately deny somebody who has been on JobKeeper or JobSeeker or has seen their income decline by a certain degree in the first or in the last few months of this financial year?
Yeah.
Was the ATO legitimately going to argue that you didn't take this money out of your superannuation fund for the pure purposes of a tax deduction, when most people could legitimately argue that, like what you said.
Yeah, they didn't know. They weren't sure what was going
to
happen.
I didn't know, but I didn't want to be caught short.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, with the uncertainty that was going on in my business or in my job or in my career at that point in time, I felt it was best for me to get early access to my superannuation.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing too is that other areas of rentals and corporate businesses that have got rent and paying rent, that other organisations have to be flexible with giving deductions on things and be a little bit kinder throughout this period. So I know the tax office is never kind, but I'm just sort of saying I wonder if they have to be a little bit more flexible with that, considering all of the things that are going on in the economy at the moment. And also to sit there and watch everyone's account, that would take an awful lot of effort for tracking down this sort of small, I guess, withdrawal from super.
Well, here's how I reckon the ATO would most easily pick it up. Everyone does a tax return in Australia, and the ATO has the data from that. Because your super is linked to your tax file number. You can't get a coronavirus withdrawal without having a tax file number. So if in the same tax year, the ATO sees that you've got both a coronavirus withdrawal from super and a tax deductible contribution to super within the one financial year, that's going to be their flag.
Okay.
And certainly if you do it this financial year, I think if you're going to take the 10 out this year and then put it back in before the 30th of June, I think that's a red flag. But remember, if you can use the carry forward provisions, right? Mm-hmm. So whatever deduction you don't claim this financial year, you can roll forward into next financial year and and maybe if you're smart about it, you wait until January or February next year before you make the contribution when things to look as though they've improved. I mean, I don't know how the ATO is going to make an argument to suggest that you didn't do that for legitimate purposes. If you had a genuine concern at the time that your job may be at jeopardy.
Can I just stand up for the law before it sounds like we're encouraging some kind of action?
Sure.
The law is: your primary purpose cannot be to obtain a tax deduction. So we are not discussing. Here's what we're not discussing on the podcast: how to avoid Part 4A of the Tax Act. That is not what we're discussing.
Well, wink, wink, Louie.
And stop talking about Fight Club.
And I think that's a very loose terminology. Primary purpose. I could explain it to be anything.
Absolutely, and not that we're encouraging this. I'm just saying there are loopholes with that, and it would be very hard. I think the thing is, if you're going to enforce something like that, you need to put out some kind of communications pretty early, stating why people can't do it. Not a cute picture with, a little character on it.
So, in conclusion, the official line is that you cannot do a coronavirus withdrawal from super for the sole or dominant purpose of obtaining a tax benefit. Okay. Don't do it. You can do it where the dominant purpose is a legitimate reason that you need the cash.
All right.
It's for cash flow, whether it's because you're worried, whether it's for potential mortgage payments that are coming up or something like that, which I'm sure there is a legitimate reason if you or your family has had a reduction in income.
Yes. Very good advice, Louis. And wink, wink, guys. Quick break. And we'll be back after this message.
Are you concerned about your finances?
Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Okay, welcome back, guys. I think Louis had a minor heart attack. But we're now going to throw over to Brett.
You're still with us, Louis? You're still there, mate? Louis?
Yep.
I'm just taking some deep breaths.
Louis was not implicated in that at all. That was me just giving my advice there. And I am not a trained financial advisor, so do not listen to me. But anyway, over to Brett. We're going to talk about Westpac's forecast and migration and housing demand.
Yeah, let's see if I can keep this as entertaining as the last session. I thought I'd go down this path today because the last couple of weeks I've spoken about some of the economic forecasts that the bigger banks have released, and Westpac are one of them that I hadn't touched on. And their report recently is more about population and housing demand more than values. One thing I'll start with here, there seems to be a bit of a levelling out or a consensus across all of the major banks and the other data researchers around where the property market's likely to be in 12 months. So what I've noticed is pretty much every forecast I've seen in the last 2 to 3 weeks is around the same level. So you'd expect that because they're probably using all the same data and running the same modelling. But the consensus seems to be that the Australian house price median value is likely to decline between 10 and 15% over the next 12 to 18 months. That seems to be what everyone's pushing.
And Brett, I tell you what, when everyone is lined up on one side of the trade, I'm going to bet against it.
There we go. Yep. I'm yet to see anyone else come out with any public research or data to say different. So they all seem to just be following each other at the moment.
Yeah.
Now, the biggest,
which probably assures us that we're going to have the strongest property market that we've ever seen.
Well, and this is the interesting thing. I haven't got the data here in front of me, but the last two times we've had recession type environments like the GFC and obviously the previous recession before that, housing performed really well immediately following those events. So if history is anything to go by, we should see property recover and boom again as soon as all of this starts to level out. So I'll come back to the Westpac report I've been reading and the biggest bunch of data that they've put out. It's not necessarily around the values. It's more around the volume and how immigration impacts housing demand. Mm-hmm. So we've already seen that the volume of new listings is down and the amount of sales has dropped. So to put some data around that perspective, so there's been a decline of 45% between February and April in terms of house sales compared to previous years, and a 35% drop in new listings in that same period. So much less activity, which we're aware of. We've been speaking about it. Now, Westpac is still expecting a 40% slump in overall turnover, which would take us back to, there's not really a data to say, but it's taking us back to historical lows in terms of the amount of sales. They don't actually have a year, but I would imagine it's taking us back 20 to 30 years in terms of the amount of sales that they're forecasting to happen. What they're using as a big part of the support behind this is the lack of migration. Obviously, borders are closed, so we can't expect new people to be migrating here. So they're expecting that our net migration is going to more than halve over the next year. So typically, our population has been growing close to 400,000 or about 1.5% over the last 5 years or so. And of that 400,000, nearly 250,000 are from migrants coming in from overseas. The forecast that Westpac have put out is that they believe that'll be less than 110,000 next year, so less than half the amount of migrants. And based on that, they're seeing that there'll be an underlying demand for housing will drop from typically what's been around 180,000 dwellings a year down to closer to 100,000 dwellings a year.
Brett, I've just got to ask, do you think that people will not want to come because they're scared of the coronavirus? Because I would have thought Australia's sort of a safe place that you'd think you'd want to come to, or is it nothing, job prospects?
Nothing to do with that. It's purely they won't be able to get in here.
Okay.
Border closures.
But, I mean, do we really think that the border closures are going to go on that long for us, or?
Well, it's a bit of an unknown, but the fact that they've already been closed for a while means that just on average numbers, we've missed probably 3 months of migration. So you could already discount that amount.
And no signs to fast track where we were to sort of help that get back on track. I'm just curious. I don't know much about that kind of a policy, but will the government sort of increase it?
Not if it's going to impact their employment numbers.
Yeah, okay.
They're not going to suddenly let in 6 months' worth of migrants in the seventh month because too many of them will join the unemployment line, and that will affect the government's so-called economic recovery.
Okay.
And, that's just the cynic in me. They won't let that happen.
And if you look at those figures, Steph, if the last 5 years we've been averaging around 20,000 a month of net migration, to restart that machine and get it up and running again, they're probably not geared to process higher volumes than that.
Mm.
So even once the borders are open, and we probably have some limitations on where migration may come from, if there's certain countries that have still got a very high risk of the coronavirus, Australia might keep borders closed to some areas.
Yeah, sure.
So it's still a bit of an unknown. So there's definitely going to be a drop. It's just a matter of how big a drop and for how long it's sustained.
Mm.
So
interesting.
One of the other parts of this that I thought would sort of push back on some of this data a little bit, not so much about the migration. I think that's a fair estimate, and it's going to be something that will take a while before we can really see the full impact. But CoreLogic release every week their early market indicators. So this is in response to what I just read about Westpac saying that volumes and transactions they believe are going to continue to decline. Interestingly, CoreLogic have actually noticed that their early market indicators, one of the major ones being pre-listing activity, people starting to research what their property's worth and starting to engage with real estate agents for appraisals. It's actually up 15% this week.
Okay.
So that shows more people feeling confident and starting to look to enter the market again. And in terms of sales volumes, the total sales volumes across the country were up nearly 4% from last week and up over 8% for the month from last month. Flies in the face a little bit about Westpac saying that they believe the transaction volumes are going to continue to climb. So I think, as Joel alluded to earlier, there's a bit of confidence out there that's starting to come back. I think the majority of the people want things to resume, and they're going to take any opportunity to make it resume normal activities when they can.
I suppose a lot of people have had a bit of time to research too while they've been in coronavirus lockdown.
I think there's always this part of this thought in any Australian's mind that, I'd love to be a property investor or I'd love to have more property investments. There's always interest from every person in Australia to be invested in property.
Yeah.
And this situation provides an opportunity for a lot of people to come off the sidelines and enter into the market. Mm. So this kind of the cynic in me is just pinging here, and I'm just wondering if all the banks are providing some signals, firstly to the population and secondly to government, and I'll get to the government point later, but by signalling to the population that property markets are in for a significant decline, they're kind of signalling to everyone there's going to be property investment opportunities, so get your finances ready now, and that will provide some support to the market over the coming months. That's my first cynical thought. My second cynical thought is the government needs stable banks and financial system during an economic crisis. And if the banks are signaling to the government, this is what is probably going to happen, then the conversations behind the scenes might be, we need some kind of support from government so that we don't have that situation happen, such as in the GFC, there was the doubling of the first home buyer grant.
Well, I actually was going to ask about that, Louis, because a staff member of mine the other day had mentioned something to me, and it's not something that I've read myself, but that there's a new first home buyer grant that's coming out, and he mentioned something about being up to $50,000. Do any of you know about that?
Haven't researched it, Steph. Don't know.
No. I haven't heard anything about that. The most recent thing I've talked about on this podcast was the first home buyers guarantee, where people, first home buyers who would have to pay lenders' mortgage insurance, actually receive a guarantee from the government, so that the bank doesn't have to charge lenders' mortgage insurance. And I could see that in some situations it could be $50,000 or more. That'd be maybe not on the amount, on the size of property you're allowed to buy and the potential insurance that could be paid. But it could definitely be $20,000 or
$30,000.
Now, here it is. Sure.
The Property Council of Australia has proposed a scheme that will encourage first home buyers to break into the market after COVID. The scheme will grant $50,000 to first-time home buyers of newly constructed dwellings. So there you go.
Okay, so it's proposed. It's not official.
No.
Okay. Right. Oh, there
guys,
you go.
I want to. I just want to outline the positive things that could support the property market going forward. I'm contrary to the banks, right? I actually don't see a big housing decline. In fact, not any of the analysis that I'm seeing that's taking place in the economy or the property market at this point in time leads me to believe that we're seeing the sorts of conditions that would lead to a major property market decline. In fact, I see the opposite, to be honest with you. And now I know that that's quite contrary to what the popular media would have you believe. But let's just have a look at some of the key driving forces that historically have supported real estate and asset prices, being stocks or commodities, historically. There's an old saying, don't fight the Fed. Well, that's the same thing here in Australia, is don't fight the Reserve Bank. Now, the Reserve Bank has lowered interest rates to all-time lows. We now have an interest rate at 0.25%. Mortgage rates at the moment are just a tick above 2%, the lowest they've ever been in the history of our federation. We have, yes, unemployment is increasing, but most of that unemployment is temporary unemployment. We haven't been forced into a situation where we've seen mass retrenchments and forced selling of real estate at this point in time. I'm not seeing any signs of real seller distress and panic selling in the real estate market at the moment. What we're really seeing more is a bit of a transaction holiday rather than a forced selling epidemic on the back of major wave of defaults. People aren't defaulting on their loans and their mortgages at the moment because the banks are giving them bank holidays, interest repayment holidays. And, we're now starting to come through that. So I can see that, yes, we've gone through more of a holiday rather than a complete economic retrenchment that leads to a major wave of selling. Mm. And so I'm probably on the outside here, in that I would not be surprised to see this real estate market really strengthen quite significantly in the back half of this year and into the early part of next year. So we'll see what happens, right? There are many, many, many smart people who work for the banks, but you know, when I just look at historically how things have performed when we see these types of policy responses in the past, and I also just get the feedback from many people, boots on the ground, who are working in the industry, there's no bargains out there. There just isn't. And That's not what you would see if you're going to see a 10 or a 15% correction in real estate.
Yeah.
I think we could coin a new phrase here on the back of obviously what you've said there, Joel, but also the cynicism that Louis put forward. We could call it the Harvey Norman effect of property, where they're basically saying we're on sale by forecasting 10% drops and then following it up with interest-free periods by offering such low prices.
The Harvey Norman market, yes. Yeah.
I like it, Brett. Market, yeah.
Saying, properties are all on sale and we're going to give you cheap money to go and buy them, so get out there.
Yeah, that's right. I think what's most at risk for the banks is the bank's profitability, and banks are trying to look out for their share prices.
Yeah.
I think the profits of bank are more at risk than the property market itself. But that being said, I do think there still is a possibility of a property market drop, because it's still a financial market, and there could still be a drop in value. Mm. So I wouldn't take it as a certainty that it's going to hold its value from here. So Joel, I think I slightly disagree with you. I'm a bit more open to the possibility of a decline in value. But I am in agreement that it wouldn't be significant. So I don't think it'd be a huge amount of a decline, so maybe less than 10%. And I do agree that it wouldn't be for a long time. It would only be a short blip in the market. And where are we now? Late May, so probably early June by the time listeners are listening to it. Maybe through most of it by the end of the year, and certainly early next year, I think we'll be above where we are currently.
All right.
I'd also throw at that, Louis, the forecast that they're putting, that, you know, the 10 to 15% declines, that's just an overall average. They're just saying, you know, based on all markets, all data. And we've been saying for a long time in the way we look at property that you can't look at the overall market as one indicator. Yeah. There's so many variables in the market, different areas, different types of dwellings, different drivers in different regions that, you know, it may be heavily driven by the high density dwellings in Sydney and Melbourne that might bring it down because there's not the migration and the students. Who knows what'll be the way that that overall drop is actually calculated if and when it does happen.
Yeah,
but I think everyone needs to be open to that. That doesn't mean that there aren't good properties around that will still be worth buying.
And remember that the reporting on it is driven by what transactions are actually happening. So even if property values haven't changed, but you've suddenly got a lot more transactions happening of $400,000 properties, then that will affect what they call the median price. Yeah. Because it's volume based on transactions. It doesn't, and there can be situations, especially in a time like this, where you might have a lot more of those lower value transactions happening. And I think that was certainly the case in the GFC. There was a heap more lower value transactions happening than high value transactions.
Yeah.
And that was skewing what was being reported as the median price.
Yeah.
And look, just coming back to the banks and their share prices, we had a conversation about this yesterday in one of the meetings. The banks don't meet our criteria to buy, but like if you are a Warren Buffett type value investor and you're looking at Westpac that is, you know, was trading at $35 a share back in 2017 and I think got as high as $40 in 2015, and now today is only trading at $18. And you think about what the banks have gone through over the past 3 or 4 years, a tightening of regulation, a Royal Commission, and now a forced bank interest rate, a loan repayment holiday from a number of their loans as a result of COVID. I mean, does it get any worse in terms of a 5-year stretch for the banks? You know, is this the worst of it now? And do the banks now, are they now able to put this horror 5-year stretch behind them and maybe better days ahead for the banks?
Yeah, good question.
Good one. But, guys, we're going to have to wrap it up there. I'm sorry to cut you guys short, but we're on time and we've just got to go to our last segment for the day, which is You Can't Be Serious. So it's obviously going to be something we're going to have to watch in that space and see what happens down the track. But
such a spoiler sports, Steph.
I am a spoiler sport, yeah. but I'm sure our listeners have only got an hour to tune in. So any you can't be serious is for this week.
I need to make a correction for another past podcast episode as well.
My goodness, in this segment.
Oh, coming out with all the apologies and redactions today.
Is it on the tax office?
No. I talked about drunken elephants escaping from a field and causing damage to a village and then getting into a wine storage and passing out drunk in the field. Turns out that the photo is actually from the middle of 2019 of these elephants. So it's not true, guys. Sorry.
Oh. Well, it's a good story anyway.
Guys, a quick poll. Who's your favourite superhero?
Batman.
Any other takers?
Yeah, I was probably going to say Batman.
Okay.
The Wolverine.
All right. So three brothers in Bolivia have taken the fantasy to extremes by trying to become their favourite superhero in Spider-Man. And they've found a Black Widow spider and aggravated it until it bit the three of them.
Oh, no.
In an attempt to try and turn into Spider-Man themselves.
Oh. How old were these people?
Three brothers were 8, 10, and 12.
Okay, I was like, I thought you were going to say that 38, 40, and 42.
Yeah, the three of us could be.
did they survive?
Their mother found them, came home to find them ill, took them to hospital where they recovered over 5 days of sweating muscle pains and fever.
Oh, wow. Geez.
Well, I've got one on a little bit of a lighter and fluffier note. A Helsinki bakery has saved itself from financial ruin during the coronavirus pandemic by creating a special cake that looks like a. Any guesses?
Oh,
like a coronavirus.
A toilet roll.
Oh, that's what we need.
Yes, apparently. Apparently, that wasn't a chocolate cake.
Carol's the inside. Oh, God.
No, this cake
melted
actually
chocolate fudge in the middle.
It looks like a nice piece of work, actually. But apparently this cake was such a hit that this bakery was able to add staff during the coronavirus pandemic because it, like its real counterpart, was selling off the shelves in a huge herd buying spree.
Wow.
It's just what you need.
You sure
cake
not.
And toilet paper. I love it. Good one, guys. Any more for today or that's it for you guys?
That's it for me.
Good one. We'll wrap it up there. But thanks again for your time today and for our listeners for tuning in. And we'll be back again next week.
Thanks, Steph.
Have a great weekend, guys.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Bye.